ever seen. 70 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva at 10 past 8. The morning show is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This month marks the 10th anniversary of the landmark 2015 Supreme Court decision, which established marriage equality as the law of the land throughout the United States. In honor of that anniversary, and in honor of the last day of Pride Month, we have a special interview with the co-author of a book called Love, The Heroic Stories of Marriage Equality. And part two of today's program is an interview which also concerns marital equality. And by the way, yesterday's podcast of The Morning Show featured two archival interviews from 2009, which also deal with the topic. If you're interested in hearing that, seek out the podcast version of the program by looking for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Here's part one of today's program. As we approach the end of Pride Month, it is important for us to take a few moments to talk about the long, hard fight for marital equality. And one way to explore that extraordinary story is to take in hand a new book called Love, The Heroic Stories of Marriage Equality. This book examines and celebrates the long and twisting and turning history of how marital equality in the United States was ultimately achieved. And it is a story told with stories, by and large. The stories of actual human beings, of couples who grappled with this reality, with all of the barriers confronting them, desiring to be married. Men marrying men, women marrying women. And the struggles that this involved, the heartbreak, the frustration, and ultimately the great gratifying victories achieved at no small cost. And of course, it is also a reality that these rights are in some respects vulnerable. Some would say even in peril. And it makes it even more important for us to understand the long struggle to achieve them in the first place, and what will be required to retain them. A number of talented people are responsible for putting this book together, including my morning show guest, Frankie Frankeny, creator of the Just Married Project, which has been documenting the marriage equality movement since 2004. I hasten to add that this book extends well before 2004 in telling this story so comprehensively. The book is published by Rizzoli. Frankie Frankeny, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
I want to add that the book is beautiful to look at. I mean, it's a work of art in many respects in terms of the powerful photographs that we find here, and it's just beautifully put together. What can you tell us about how this book was put together and the way in which this important story was to be told?
Well, I started this project in 2004. I started documenting and researching these stories in 2004 when Hillary and Julie Goodridge had just won the right to marry in the first state in Massachusetts. And my friends in San Francisco were receiving refunds for their marriages, if you will. They had joyously married along with 8,000 other couples. And after Gavin Newsom opened the door to marriage equality for the first time in California. But the state shut it down, the state court shut it down, and they were all, you know, after having their beautiful weddings and their honeymoons, they received information that their marriage licenses were voided and no longer valid. And it really impressed upon me the how important their stories were to me and how important Hillary and Julie's story were to our community, to their state, but also to our community nationwide. And I thought, well, I wanted to keep telling those stories. And at that time, the woman I was with, we started the Just Married Project. So we started Just Married, a website, One Couple Courting Marriage Equality, where we told our story. It's just an everyday as a writer and a photographer. But I continued to collect the stories, and the more stories I collected, the more I realized that truly these were the only things that were changing public opinion, changing politicians' minds, and changing the minds of judges.
One of the attorneys who was such a key player in the ultimate achievement of marital equality, Evan Wolfson, who is featured in the book and also has written one of the introductions to the book, writes, "A central lesson reflected in this book is the power of stories, sharing the truths about our lives and connecting them to the shared values of the people we still need to reach." That brings to mind one of the couples that I want to have you talk about, because it's so interesting to think about the different ways in which people contributed to this long struggle. And this is jumping a bit ahead into the history, but I just want us to take a moment to talk about Deborah Price and Joyce Murdoch. And Deborah Price was a writer and editor for the Detroit News. For the sake of any of our listeners, and maybe most of our listeners who will not immediately recognize these names, explain the important work that Deborah Price did on behalf of this movement.
Okay, sure. So Deborah Price had the first nationally syndicated column on queer life, on everyday queer life, in 1992, in the pages of the Detroit News. And her first column, which we actually reprinted in the book because I thought it was so important that this went out as a national column, and it was titled "Trying to Find a Name for a Gay Partner." And in an era where, you know, there weren't very many queer voices, and certainly not covered in the mainstream media, this column really marked a significant, I think, moment by the couple bravely talking about their everyday lives. And while they did talk about, in this particular column, what do I call Joyce? Partner doesn't seem right. That seems like something for business. You know, she talked about significant other. But I think while that column was, I think, vital, because we all needed to know, wanted a way to name ourselves, and I don't think at this point anybody was looking for husband and wife, which holds significant historical meaning. We were just looking for something. And Deborah and Joyce really got the conversation going. But there's ongoing columns where people could see them as everyday, ordinary people discussing, you know, politics or maybe the laundry, and how they divvy up chores around the house. they really demystified being gay for a lot of people, maybe in the same way Ellen would do decades later on her talk show.
Right.
And I think it was really vital for us to hear, for many of us to hear her voice. And I think it opened the door to many other people coming out. And on that note, I will say that I think it sounds like you've gone through the book quite extensively, but the win for marriage equality and the win for all of our rights absolutely can't be separated from individual people coming out. So and telling their stories. People had to come out so that people knew about them, and then people would tell their stories, and the more people came out, more people came out because they came out and they felt brave to do it. And then the more people came out, everybody told their stories, whether it was to just a good friend or a family member, why being out was important and telling their story was important, and ultimately why having civil rights, like not being a criminal, as Lawrence v. Texas essentially did, it decriminalized just being gay, and it certainly stopped the regular harassment of gay people. And then eventually marriage equality.
Right. I like how, as you summarize the legacy of Deborah Price, you say the legacy of Deborah Price and Joyce Murdoch is profound in fostering a climate of understanding. And yes. I appreciate the fact that this is highlighted as one of many important elements or ingredients in this long, arduous struggle. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Frankie Frankeny, who is one of the people responsible for a remarkable new book called Love, The Heroic Stories of Marriage Equality. Early on, we read that this book goes out of its way to highlight the diversity of the movement and points to the fact that sometimes this movement was incorrectly characterized as being mostly rather privileged whites who happened to be gay, fighting for this particular cause, when in fact, as we read your book, we realize that that there were many, many different people from very different walks of life who were part of this long struggle. Why was that so important to you, that this aspect of this long struggle be highlighted so clearly?
I think because of, well, A, what you said, and I think partially one of the reasons that it felt to a lot of people that this was largely a white led movement was because there, I believe, this is my own personal opinion, that one of the main goals was to reach that aspect of middle America, that large, movable voting block. And so I think some of those court cases may have been chosen for that reason. But again, another reason for me was that one thing that I often have heard across the several decades of creating this project and putting these stories together was that the fight, especially towards the end, that the fight for marriage equality happened really fast, when in fact, it didn't happen really fast. It happened over the course of seven decades with many voices, not just court cases, but voices that stood up and told their story, whether it was for survival or not. And if it did feel fast, I think it's because one of the unique things is that as we all began to tell our stories, come out and tell our stories, we weren't telling them just to the media, we were telling them to our communities that we grew up in. And indeed, gay people are everywhere. We are Muslim, we are atheists, we are Christians, we are white, black, brown, Asian, we are old, we're young, we are disabled, we are super athletes, we're everywhere. And because of that, the more people came out, the more people told their stories, we infiltrated all our stories. You know, we're able to be heard in every community because we are indeed there. And as people came out and told their stories, you know, unlike when a disenfranchised group is generally their community is within one community, where we are omnipresent in all communities.
Right. One of the things I appreciate about your book, as I said earlier, is the long historic view that it takes. So, for instance, we hear the really lovely and remarkable story of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, whom you call a rare and valuable model of queer domesticity. We hear the story of Mildred and Richard Loving, who are not a same-sex couple. They were an interracial couple, and it was really their case that ultimately led to the downfall of laws that forbade interracial marriage in so many parts of the country, and that was part of this struggle. I want to take a moment to talk about something else from early in the book, and that is when you talk about what sounds like an extraordinary book of photographs that I am very, very anxious to see. A collection of photographs over the course of many, many decades of men in love. And this would be, in a sense, a different kind of story in which there are absolutely no words whatsoever, but images, in many cases, deeply poignant images of men in love at a time when that was an outrageous thought for most Americans. Tell our listeners about this book. It's one of a number of books, other books on the topic that you highlight very generously in your book. But tell our listeners about what I'm talking about.
Sure. This book is called Loving, and it's by Hugh Meany and Neil Treadwell. It's a delightful book. They're two guys who were, I guess, originally in Dallas. They're in New York now, but they started collecting. Well, they found a few photos of what they believed were men who were couples, and they just thought that was an anomaly. But as they continued to go to different flea markets and such, they started finding more. They now have a collection of, I think, 6,000 from around the world. But as a photographer, it was really I was really moved by that book personally. They haunt me in some of the best and, I guess, hardest ways. I think because so many of those images were taken in secret, people knew that just the discovery of a single photo could mean real danger at that time. The loss of their families, the loss of jobs, just ostracized from their communities, loss of their children, or even being institutionalized. And our community has never really had that luxury for safety, and yet they dared. You know, they dared to take a photograph so that they could hold something in their hands that reflected the reality of their true lives, something beautiful, something real. And that kind of courage to me, quiet, anonymous, is still so deeply human, and it left an incredible mark on me, and I believe it leaves an incredible mark on everybody who sees the book, because it's a very successful book and people really do love it, and they've just done a second one.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Frankie Frankeny about her new book, Love, The Heroic Stories of Marriage Equality. The book tries to put to rest what it calls the misconception that the right to marry was won quickly. This book shows the long, arduous journey couples undertook to secure their rights. We have already once mentioned Evan Wolfson, the attorney who was so important in this long struggle. I knew something about him and his legacy, but one thing I did not realize until I read your book and your summary of his work, that he was the target of some criticism. Not just from people who opposed the notion of marital equality, of course, but also he was criticized by some members of the gay community who were not sure that giving such attention and energy to the cause, the specific issue of marital equality, was appropriate or helpful when there were all kinds of other pressing issues, particularly in the time when AIDS was such a horrendous presence in the landscape. Can you talk more about the nature of this criticism and what kind of a difference it ultimately made?
Well, sure. Evan, he's known as the national architect of marriage equality, at least the strategy of it all, having written his Harvard thesis in 1983 on the subject, advocating for the freedom to marry. And I think, I know that the strategies that he laid out, his thoughts in that thesis, would ultimately become the foundation for the strategy that was used in the 2000s to actually win marriage equality. And yes, people did think he was crazy for an overreaching, for going for something that most people never truly imagined would ever happen in their lifetime. But I think ultimately Evan understood it as the holy grail of dignity for our community. And that's one thing I try to stress when I talk to people about the beauty of Love's Win in 2015 and why we can't let it go back. And that's because finally, for the first time for a decade now, children can now dream the same dreams as their classmates. And I think for Evan and I, we think that that's the biggest and the most beautiful thing to come out of this, the dignity that we have and the dignity bestowed upon children who can now, when they realize at 5 or 15 or 25, whenever that they are attracted to somebody of the same sex and they would like to eventually maybe marry somebody, that they now have, they can dream that. They can dream that their parents will be excited when they say that they're in love or that they're engaged, and they can dream that their community will be around them to celebrate this important milestone that we put at the top of the pedestal for as humans. And it's such a beautiful stigma that we have removed for these new generations. And again, I think that by having 70% of Americans say that we deserve this right, it's almost like an apology for all the years that we suffered not having this, that we suffered being othered by people telling us in a variety of ways that our love wasn't as worthy as our classmates or our brothers and sisters or our parents, and or that our families weren't worth protecting the way other families are worth protecting. So in a way, this says to us, yes, you are equal. You have that dignity.
Right. And, I think you are so right to say that this was a long and hard struggle, that this did not happen overnight. That is absolutely beyond dispute. On the other hand, as you are talking about the remarkable majority of Americans who now support marital equality, that feels, in a sense, in the grand scheme of things, like it happened nearly overnight. And I mean, not to diminish this long struggle, but I don't think we can point to many instances in recent history in which public opinion on a certain issue changed so dramatically, so decisively. I mean, the struggle to get to that moment where things flipped was a long and hard one. But I suspect you will agree that the flipping of that opinion occurred in a way that I think most of us could never imagine happening in such a relatively brief amount of time.
I absolutely agree. And again, I think that is a factor of two things, which I already mentioned. Massive amounts of people coming out, inspiring more people to come out. And also the fact that we are in every community outside of our own community. So that between those two things, Republican kids came out to their to the Republican parents. You know, when Dick Cheney decided he was okay telling the world that he was proud of his lesbian daughter and his grandchild and stuff like that, it made a difference. It had a ripple effect on many people who thought, you know, who were far to the right on the subject, and who believed that, well, if it's okay with Dick, it's okay with us.
Yeah, right. Cool with it. Yes.
Yeah, really. And these did make a difference. And the more, you know, Hollywood people came out and talked to their fans, and that's one reason I have some of them in there, because their stories really made a difference. You know, Ellen risked it all in 1997 just coming out, and then that eventually led to more and more and more people coming out. And as more people came out and more celebrities came out, and George Takei and then Wanda Sykes, and, you know, there was just a flood between 2008 after Prop 8 and 2015. And when celebrities come out, then people who love celebrities come out, or grandmothers say, you know, I don't care about Ellen and Portia. I love them. They're great. If that makes them happy, I don't care. And when you change grandmothers' minds, well, there you go.
You're right. So that's great.
Yeah. It was just the coming out that really made such a huge difference.
Of course. I want to end with one of the couples. I mean, many of the couples will be relatively well-known in many ways, kind of the public face of this long struggle, and it's so good to hear from them and hear about them. But I want to end with, in some ways, a very ordinary couple that I think most of us have never heard of, Jack Evans and George Harris. Their story told at the very end of the book, and it's subtitled A Long Southern Love Story. And we see these two elderly faces, sweet faces, looking out at us from this beautiful photograph. Can you just tell us about this couple and why they are part of this this book?
Sure. And no, there's an earlier, I believe it's in chapter 2, I think, and then maybe the lead or the second story is of them much younger in the 70s. I'll note that to you when you go back and look. I love that picture. But, they after 54 years, they were able to say, I do. And, they began, I think they met each other at a Dallas bar in 1961. I do believe that was actually, and George became instantly smitten with Jack, and they fell in love, and they started their life together. But I think the AIDS epidemic really affected them in a way that they slowly became more out in Dallas, where they were living. They played a key role in co-founding the Stonewall Business Association there, which laid the groundwork for the LGBT Chamber of Commerce in North Texas. And they won several Lifetime Achievement Awards. They were, you know, proudly in parades out there. And in Texas, none of this was a small feat. You know, it was truly brave. And for me, I really wanted to show these people that are like many people who made a difference in their community. And they may not have been known by many outside of it, but their stories, They were known in their communities. They made a difference in their communities, and that made a difference there.
Right.
But then they also tell their stories in, you know, post Prop 8, and people, it really made a difference when people saw, when everyday people who didn't understand saw people like Jack and George, or Jack and Michael, or Phyllis and Dell. They saw these beautiful long-term relationships. It snapped away any notion that they had that, or that they'd been told that queer people can't have loving, long, beautiful relationships, and that they deserve to have, you know, benefit from each other's social security and the protections. And when they die, they deserve for their death certificates to say that they were married and that they had a long-term spouse. In most cases before Obergefell, these death certificates would simply say they were single, and they weren't, and they didn't want to go down with that history. And I think people really understood that. And while I think it's easier for people to hate on younger people, I think it's harder for them to do that with older people. And I think that they just bring their own level of beauty and joy and resilience to storytelling.
You call them a symbol of hope and perseverance. And
yes.
And George Harris, after he lost his husband, Jack Evans, said, "He taught me how to love." And I think that's the greatest gift you can ever give to anybody.
I know. I'm just tears right now every time I hear that line or read that line. But it is true. I mean, whoever teaches you to love, whether it's a person or your dog or your grandmother or your parents or anybody, it's the most beautiful thing. Most people don't even get to a point where, you know, they know how to love and give love back. And that's just such a beautiful line.
Well, then that's, of course, the title of your book, Love, The Heroic Stories of Marriage Equality, published by Rizzoli, and the author, Frankie Frankini. Thank you so much for giving the world this important book, and thank you for being my morning show guest. I was honored to speak with you. Best wishes.
I'm so honored to be here. Thank you so, so much.
I want to add that there is an appendix at the back of the book that I very much appreciate, which brings to the reader's attention 36 different books and films about marital equality. Also, there is a really interesting list headlined Lessons in Social Change from Winning Marriage. This is excerpted from Mark Solomon's book, Winning Marriage, in which he talks about some of the lessons learned from this long struggle. Lessons potentially applicable to other social movements. They are: convey a bold, inspirational vision, have an overarching strategy, focus on values and emotions, meet people where they are, find the right messengers, build state campaigns designed to win, invest heavily in local organizing. Except this reality, politicians care about re-election above almost everything else. Be serious about reaching across the aisle and build momentum every day. And each of these tenets is explained. That's just one more feature of this wonderful book, which is also replete with all kinds of amazing photographs. The book again is Love, The Heroic Stories of Marriage Equality by Frankie Frankini, published by Rizzoli. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And to finish out today's morning show on this last day of Pride Month, I'm excited to be able to spend a few minutes talking with Dr. Patricia Grayhall, who is a medical doctor. She's had a 40-year career in medicine and also an award-winning author. One of her books, a memoir called Making the Rounds, Defying Norms in Love and Medicine, and a romance novel co-authored with her wife, author Linda M. Ford. Her latest book is a novel called A Place for Us, and it draws upon some of the more difficult realities of Dr. Grayhall's life. What happens when one falls in love with someone from another country, and because of certain immigration laws, there is no provision which allows you to move together, to travel together, to settle down together in a life together. And this novel creates a similar scenario to the one that Dr. Grayhall experienced earlier in her life. So we'll talk about the parallels of fact and fiction and about what prompted Dr. Grayhall to want to write this book and share it with the world. Again, A Place for Us, a novel published by She Writes Press, which is distributed by Simon & Schuster. And Dr. Patricia Grayhall, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I wonder if we could just talk for a moment before we dig into the book about being a doctor and at the outset of your career 40 years ago, what it was like to be a doctor and to be gay. And
sure.
Was that a significant issue or difficulty or barrier? And if so, what were the most significant ways in which your work as a doctor, for instance, was complicated?
Right. So I got into medical school before Title IX guaranteed equal access to education for women. So my class in Salt Lake City was 95% men, and I was one of only five women. And because of the barriers to equal education for women, I had very few female mentors. And so, you know, that was a challenge, but I rose to the occasion by forming allies with some of my fellow medical students, and also I had some supportive professors throughout. Certainly, I did have to hide my identity. It wouldn't have gone over well in Salt Lake City for me to be out at that time. And so I ended up forming a very close friendship with a fellow medical student, a male, who didn't know it at the time, but was also gay. And you know, we got through it. And I think my first book, Making the Rounds, which was a memoir, does offer hope that to young people that, you know, we've been in dark times before, and we have managed to thrive and lead amazing lives nevertheless. So both my books, I think, are hopeful books in that regard.
Mm. Tell us about your real life experience that is, at least to some extent, paralleled in your new novel, the aptly named novel, A Place for Us. Tell our listeners about you and your British partner and
sure.
What you experienced, and then we'll get into the novel and how that is a reflection of what you experienced.
Right. Yeah, so in 2003, when I got together for the second time with my current partner, it was not possible for us to live together legally in either the UK or the United States at that time. This was before marriage equality. And in 2002, Canada had, for the first time, recognized same-sex couples for immigration. However, we would have had to prove that we'd live together as conjugal partners for at least a year. However, there was no country in which we could live together legally for a year, so it was a catch-22. And a part of the book is really how we negotiated that conundrum.
Did you feel in the midst of it like there might not be any way out? I mean, at the most difficult or frustrating moments, what were your deepest fears?
Well, at every juncture, it seemed like we were doomed. And this is what makes my current novel more like a romantic suspense novel, because there were barriers at every step of the way that we had to overcome. Which we ultimately did, but it was hairy.
Mm. I'm curious, you could have made the decision to write a work of essentially nonfiction, I mean a memoir about this particular experience, but instead chose to use the vehicle of fiction to write a novel kind of reflecting some of this experience. I'm just curious why you thought that was a good way to go.
Well, I think our story, our immigration story and how we got together was very dramatic, so that's formed the nucleus. But fiction, autofiction is my sweet spot now for writing because it allows me to go beyond my own experience to explore some of the big messy issues that affect all of us, not just the queer community. So in A Place for Us, I explore partner abuse with the exes of the two protagonists, and which is a complicated issue because there's love and there's good times and there's there's hope that the partner will change, and this traps people sometimes in a web that's where it's difficult for them to act in their own self-interest. And so that was just one of the issues I wanted to explore. I also, which is totally fictional, I have an oil spill taking place in the Arctic National Refuge because I wanted to explore some of those, the issues of environmental, the ravages of, on the environment. So the autofiction just gives me the opportunity to tell the emotional truth of the story, but also to go beyond that.
Right.
It's like Grace Paley said, write from what you know and write into what you don't know. And that's why what I do.
I like that.
In this book.
Your character, Joe, is described as a driven environmental attorney. And she meets a young woman from Britain who, in some respects at least, could not be more different. Describe these two women as they first meet, and then we'll talk about the encounter which they have with one another many years later.
Right. So Jo is, she's an ambitious environmental attorney based in Washington, D.C., and Lauren is a government employee, but she's a free-spirited adventurer who takes risks. And they meet in a lively London pub in 1981. And the attraction is instant and undeniable. But their romance is cut short by distance and Joe's career ambitions and immigration barriers. So then 2 decades later, their lives collide in San Francisco, but they're both trapped in unfulfilling relationships. But the reunion sets her passion ablaze again and offers them a second chance. But they have to navigate the wreckage of their current lives and painful truths that they've avoided for decades. But then they face their most daunting challenge yet in a world that refuses to recognize their love. How can they possibly build a life together when no country will grant them sanctuary?
I wonder if you felt any reluctance at all to pen a novel like this in which you have characters that are experiencing really difficult relationships, and only because I think probably once upon a time, more so than today, I think there was sometimes a tendency with this kind of fiction to paint things in very positive ways. And of course, that might in part be in order to create a sense that these are worthwhile relationships, just as worthwhile as other marriages and so on. I think we live now in an environment, although certainly difficult in a lot of ways, but an environment in which all kinds of love stories can be told, including love stories that are much more complicated. I just wonder if you thought about any of that as you kind of thought about the specifics of this particular story.
Absolutely. And you're totally correct. I think as with many marginalized people, we wanted to present ourselves in a positive light to the dominant culture. But in fact, you know, we're just as complicated and multifaceted and flawed as all other humans, and we have many of the same problems. And I think, especially in my first book, I really don't hold back in portraying a very honest picture of my struggles as a human being, even while going through rigorous training to become a doctor. And the same thing in this book, I bring up the issue of partner abuse just because I think that heterosexuals don't have a lock on that. You know, it happens too in the queer community. At the same time, you know, this is a place for us as a hopeful book about, you know, working through that and coming out the other side. And of course, it's a romance and it has a happy ending, as it did in real life. So.
Very good. And talk for a moment about where much of this is set, particularly when we're talking about the later part of the novel. It's almost as though certain settings are almost a character in and of themselves.
Right, right. So a lot of the drama in the middle part of the book takes place in Yosemite National Park against the backdrop of the towering cliffs. And so, yes, that is a bit of a character in the book. And also the Pacific Northwest, where they ultimately end up, well, I won't give away the plot, but very much the Pacific Northwest, the Gulf Islands off the coast of Canada, are a character in the book as well.
Well, it's a lovely choice, and I think makes a big, big difference. In our last minute or so, as you release this particular book, it is in a political landscape that is, to say the least, discomforting to the LGBTQ community. What are your hopes for what is ahead?
Well, I think, again, with this book and my previous book, it's to offer hope. I mean, young people today, I think, are shocked by the backlash and loss of rights and freedoms that they've taken for granted most of their lives. And I'm just hoping that, you know, readers will see that we've been through dark times before. And, you know, if we express our truth and strengthen our community of allies, I think, and resist tyranny in our everyday lives, I think eventually this backlash will become like a bad dream.
Hmm. The book, again, is A Place for Us, a novel. It is published by She Writes Press, which is distributed by Simon & Schuster, the author, Dr. Patricia Grayhall. Dr. Grayhall, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and thank you for this this intriguing and engrossing book. I enjoyed it and enjoyed talking with you about it. Best wishes.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview about fascism, and particularly the rise of fascism among young people, both here and abroad. My guest, Craig Johnson, is a fascism scholar and also the host of a podcast that focuses on the topic. His newest book is called How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock.